Hey, Startup Hustle listeners, before we get into today's episode, I've got some exciting news to share. If you've enjoyed the insights and stories here at Startup Hustle, you're going to love what we have in store at our brand new podcast called Product Driven. I've always described myself as a product guy first, entrepreneur, software engineer, but really a product guy. I love building products. Many people struggle, though, with how to take a product idea and build a tech product, while software engineers struggle to understand the business side of things and they just don't see the big picture. My new podcast, Product Driven, is about that gap between business and the tech side of building software. It's designed for startup founders, tech leaders, software engineers, and anyone who loves tech and startups. Thank you for being part of this community. Enjoy this episode of Startup Hustle, and please subscribe to Product Driven in your podcast app, and you can also check it out on YouTube. Thank you so much.
And we're back for another episode of Startup Hustle, a podcast for entrepreneurs by entrepreneurs. If you want to start, own, or build a business, then you're in the right place. We bring you the real truth about what it's like to take something from concept to launch. From growth, innovation, experience, failing, or winning big, we've got you covered. So let's get down to business with another episode of Startup Hustle, brought to you by Fullscale.io. And we're back. Another episode of Startup Hustle. Matt DeCourcy here with one of my favorite subjects today, marketing. Now, for those of you that listen and listen regularly, you know I love sales, you know I love marketing, and you know I love bringing in experts to talk about it. So with me today, I've got the founder of the Ponzi Group, Angelo Ponzi. Welcome.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Yeah, now we're going to talk about a lot of different stuff today, but let's first get a little bit of your own backstory. Now, before I get too far into that, though, I do need to remind everyone listening that today's episode of Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Now, Angelo, you own a fractional CMO company. I do want to hit on what that even is for those that might not know and get a little bit of your backstory that brought you up to the point where you are doing what you do.
Sure, absolutely. Well, I'll try to give you the history as quickly as possible, but I probably spent about 65%, give or take, of my career on the advertising side of the business. So everything from small agencies to global agencies, where I've got a lot of my training. I actually had the opportunity through my first consulting gig, which was to advertising agency. I was a freelance, we called ourselves freelance at the time instead of fractional, strategic planner and market researcher. So I worked with a lot of advertising agencies. And then one day I decided, why am I making them all this money? So I converted myself into a full service agency, had the opportunity to grow it and sell it. And then people that bought me put me into another agency for a while. The other side of the coin is I have sat on the client side of the fence, everything from ad manager to international product manager, director of marketing, director of sales and marketing, VP of marketing, CMO, and CSO, which is chief strategy officer. And what I found over the years is the part I really love to do is the strategic side of marketing. So I like to say I'm a strategic and analytical marketer. And I take a holistic view of the company because I've sat on the client side and understand whether it's a service organization or manufacturing, all the different pieces that go along with that. And so that's where I really loved what I love doing and where I wanted to focus. And so when I started this group in 2014, I only wanted to focus on providing that kind of service. I started off with myself. I have expanded and now have other marketing team members that are VPs of marketing and directors of marketing, marketing coordinators, et cetera, that can help shear up and support a company that needs help. And where we fit in is typically a company may or may not actually have a marketing department. And so typically, if they have a marketing department, they're very tactical in nature, and there's nobody in their strategic role in the C-suite, if you will, the CMO. And so that's where I come in. And the fractional work basically means is they're buying a fraction of my time. And so I may have several clients that are buying fractions of my time. I also do interim roles, and I've done that before, where I'm just actually stepping into the role of whatever they need, CMO, while they're looking for someone else. And then I still do consulting as well. So that's, you know, less hours and more coaching kinds of things. And so all of us are fractional, whatever, in marketing to fill those roles as needed to help a company grow.
Now, and I appreciate the backstory there, but I'll go ahead and raise you up a little bit here, because you've worked with some pretty big brands, including AT&T, Ericsson, Seagram's, Kettle One, Cabo Wabo, Cold Stone, Arby's. The list goes on and on. If you guys want to see more about the places that Angelo has helped create strategy with or done marketing stuff for, just scroll on down and click the link in the show notes. You can go to theponzigroup.com. Now, the term fractional is thrown around a lot. And like you mentioned, that was once known as freelance. For those of you that have ever hired an attorney, you had a fractional legal team, is I think maybe the best way for many people to wrap their arms around it. I was just talking about this subject the other day when it comes to strategy as well. You mentioned so many people have, our companies have marketing departments, and they're practitioners. They are people that often execute someone's plan, but the question is whose plan. And in this conversation I was having, I was talking to a CEO that was having a lot of marketing issues and was asking for some of my advice. And I said, it doesn't sound like you have anyone that's creating strategy. And, you know, they had a bunch of people that wanted to do one thing and wanted to do this. And, oh, well, we need to do social media and we need to do create content and we need to do whatever. But it just sounded like they were throwing things in a bunch of different directions, not necessarily having a plan. How do these all connect? How do they work with each other? What fits our brand the best? You know, and it's like, so one of the companies that Full Scale owns, which is my company, is Gigabook. And people would often ask, they'd say, well, what's your social media marketing plan? I'm like, well, people don't really get too excited about appointment software. It doesn't go viral. It's not something that, it's not like a kitten or a baby picture that everyone wants to click or like. So when it comes to strategy and a brand, I mean, where do you start when it comes to finding a good fit or an approach for a company?
Sure. And to backtrack just a second, I mean, you actually laid it out, and I would say more often than not, that is the exact example that there's confusion on what's going on. People think that doing a social campaign or doing a trade show or whatever it happens to do, whatever kind of executional or implementation plan they have, they equate that to strategy. And I find so many times that when you start to dig into it, a lot of times it's a one message fits all strategy. So they're saying the same thing in every vertical that they're talking to every type of audience that they're talking to. And the relevancy of what's important to me and to you, even though we could say we're both in the fields of marketing, what's relevant to you in a piece of communications could be very different than what's relevant to me. So I try to take it up, if you will, and look at it from that standpoint of who is the audience. So I say insights, brand, and planning is kind of the buckets I like to focus in. And insights really boils down to market research. Now, it could be secondary research, could be primary research, qualitative, quantitative, all that good stuff. But by understanding and knowing the customer is always the place that I like to start. Somebody asked me the other day, if my client could only do one thing and one thing only during this pandemic, what should they do? I said, go talk to your customers. Ask them, dig into them, find out what's going on with them, understand their motivations and behaviors and the whys. Why did they pick you over the competition? You could look for commonalities, and maybe that might help determine the strategies and the messaging that you might bring forward. So the first place I like to start when I deal with a client is I do an assessment. And I typically start with the stakeholders, the C-suite people. I need to first understand, are they in alignment? Are they in the same direction? Are in the boat rowing together, so to speak? Because a lot of times I find that they're not. They're just all over the place. Well, they think they are, but they're not. So once I understand that and we can bring that alignment and agreement on where we're going to go, then the next step is to start digging into the various departments within the organization, making sure that they're also in understanding and alignment. From an internal standpoint, I'm a huge believer in internal marketing and making sure everybody in the organization understands what's going on. Then also, as I said, understanding the customer, understanding the dynamics in the market in which you're competing, understanding the competition. Those are the places and all this gathering of information and looking for those unique nuggets that you can help differentiate your brand on. Then we get into the branding work. And the branding work for me is about strategy. I mean, from messaging, how do I uniquely message to the right audience and that helps differentiate me from the competition? So I like to work with messaging matrices and things like that. Then if there's creative involved, then, you know, I'll either work with the internal team or I'll bring in an external team to work with me. Because I have managed and run an advertising agency, I understand all that. I don't want to do all that anymore, but I understand how to get it done. And so that's where I like to play. And then, of course, the planning gets into what are we going to do tomorrow? What are we going to do 3 years from now? What are we going to do 5 years from now in order to reach your goals?
So in that same conversation that I had just mentioned, I actually asked that same person. I said, tell me what your business does and use only one line. And he said, well, we do a whole lot of stuff. And I literally like, I said, so you don't know. And he, well, I know what we do. I said, yeah, but you're not, you that message, that brand, what you're trying to say, does your customer know that? Well, we do a lot of this different stuff and blah, 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 blah. And you talk about looking at that internal form of marketing. And does your own business, like, okay, at full scale, we help you build a development team quickly and affordably. That's like the whole, that everything that we do falls underneath that one line, that one statement. And, you know, that, and you talk about talking to your customers. Like we did that when we were building the company. I mean, we got to 200 employees in 2 years. So I feel like we were doing something right. And, you know, along that way, it's like, okay, so what were the big pain points? You know, well, people wanted to save money and they didn't want to go through the hassle of recruiting workers and team members in an overly competitive market. So, you know, but I think it starts for on many levels. If you can't define your own brand and what you do, like in a sentence, then you might not understand what it is you do. So that means that trickle down effect you talk about from the C-suite. How does everyone else know the song? Like, what do we do here? And if you walk around your company, if you have multiple employees and you ask people, what do you do? You're going to freak out because you're going to find, if you haven't defined that one line message, like I said, you're going to freak out because you're going to have 10 different people tell you 10 different things. And is that what you mean by internal marketing?
Yeah. So, you know, again, getting everybody on a page. One of my clients, for example, there's a manufacturing company, distribution company, 185 people during their peak time. And I can guarantee, and I know and guaranteed myself that if I walked around and asked people what the company really did, I'd get the superficial answer. And more importantly, I'd get an answer about what their particular function was. And so I literally walked around the halls one day and I was talking to all the leaders of the company, like accounting person. And I said, so what do you think of the new strategies that we're doing about the company? And she says, I have no idea what you're talking about. I said, but you're recruiting for positions to fill and you don't know what we're really doing. I know what you think the company does, or you know what the company does, but what about why you're recruiting for these particular positions? Or the accounting person, what do you think of the new work that we're doing? I don't know. I just see the bills. And so I find so many times that there's a disconnect, because I believe that every time, you know, at 5 or 6 o'clock, whenever the day ends, 185 people walk out the door, there's 185 brand ambassadors that should be able to talk about the company and really speak to that. And so I find that if I can bring this cohesiveness, because if I know, if I've got the head of manufacturing in the room and we're talking about strategies. And so let's say we want to get to $10 million in 3 years, I'm making this up. And part of the strategy is to get that $1 million sale this year. And that'd be fantastic. And then we turn to the manufacturing guys. If we brought in $1 million sale tomorrow or next month, can we produce it? Well, I don't have the inventory for that. Or, you know, I need stuff out of China and there's no way I could get it in a couple of weeks in order to build it. So without everybody understanding what's going on in the team, you really run a risk of, well, one department's cheering, the other department could be suffering because they don't understand what's going on. That's when I mentioned about kind of a holistic approach, because everybody's all got to be working together. I quick story, I go back years ago, I worked on Burlington Air Express. I don't know if you're familiar with them, but they were trying to get into the overnight express business, and they wanted to compete with UPS and FedEx. And so we worked with them. It's when I had an ad agency, and we worked on this campaign. It was a fantastic campaign. Campaign launched, and nothing. The phone never rang. And so, of course, the VP of marketing was like, what the heck's going on? And long story short, we did a quick analysis, or they did inside. At the exact same week that the campaign launched, somebody in accounting saw a bunch of 800 numbers that were never being used and turned them off. And so the nice. Numbers were all dead, right? So that's just a simple analogy, but there's so many times there's miscommunication about what's going on. And that's why I believe that everybody inside has to understand.
I actually had it's funny and not funny because I had a similar story. We, as many, many, many years ago, we had built many at the prior company I owned to full scale. We would build our own websites that acted as marketplaces for buyers and sellers. And in a one-off contract, we had built one for. I don't want to say competitor, but a similar type business, got paid quite well. And then, you know, as we got a few months down the line, we noticed that our phone sales had dropped off quite a bit, and we couldn't figure out why. And through just kind of a matter of dumb luck, I went to that site that we had built, and I saw the phone number. And I went to some of the sites that we had been building because we owned a whole bunch of properties. And through lack of communication, we had been putting this other guy's phone number, the image that had the phone number on it at the time, had been putting them on all the new sites. So we had, you know, we had about like 15 sites, and the first 9 were killing it. They would get, you know, we'd get a repeatable number of phone orders. And then the next 6 that we built, I was like, why do these only get online orders? The phone doesn't ring, because we had ways to track that. And I was like, oh my God. So yeah. And that went on for a few months. And that was lack of communication and shitty planning. And honestly, man, it had a lot to do with us not being busy and not even looking at where our own sales were coming from. So you can have there can be some things that can occur there. And then, you know, another example, and you're right with the, hey, even if we sold this, could we fulfill it? I was talking about that because, you know, Full Scale's preparing to launch a sales partner network, and we have to kind of tiptoe into it, because I'm positive we'll get a whole lot of people that'll want to sign up for it, but we have to be able to fulfill the requests or the orders. And I was just literally in a meeting. I said, nothing will guarantee that we are wasting time with the sales partner network than having nothing to sell in the network. So there's a lot of pieces that go in there. And that's actually, I think, important stuff too, because COVID-19's created some weird supply chain issues. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we have had a guy that's been on the, some of the online grocers or our food people, you know, saw these big surges in orders. And we have one guy, Riverwatch Beef, who literally can't make beef jerky because he can't get a specific kind of salt. So he had to, you know, he is like, I'm getting all these orders, but they don't mean shit because I can't fulfill them. And he's like, I got to figure out how to make this stuff a different way. So, yeah, I think, and that's hard to do. And I think do you think the bigger your company gets, the more just that becomes even harder and harder and harder?
Oh, absolutely. I find that one of the biggest things I saw, and I'll pick on the ad business, but I also saw it on when I was client side as well, is a lot of traditional big agencies are very silo driven, right? You're in your department and you're in your lane, and you know, you just kind of don't cross pollinate. And that was one of the things that we, coming out of a big agency, when I started my original first agency and then moved into the second one, we broke that down. We had a very different and unique model that we used. Actually, that was the reason the big agency bought us, because they loved our model. But I find it in so many times that people don't communicate. They just don't communicate internally. And, you know, it really starts at the top and what that kind of the leadership that is set and the culture of the organization and how that trickles down and to open up communications. People, you know, the workers, I'll make a broad statement, are afraid to, in most cases, to speak up, especially nowadays. I mean, if you don't want to rock any boats, you're afraid to, you know, you're going to lose your job. I worked for a financial organization. There was about 150 of us at the time. I was the fractional CSO, and I did an employee survey. And the results were extremely interesting, but most of it was based on fear. There was just such fear in the organization about losing their job that they people didn't would never speak up in a meeting. They do it, you know, at the water cooler, so to speak, but they would never voice their opinions. And yet, so the organization really suffered from a really a disconnect in its culture and how they communicated and what they said on the outside about the organization, which was even worse. So yeah, I find it the bigger you get, but honestly, I've seen it in little firms too, that was just a disconnect. And again, I point to leadership that sets that culture and that, and the way people communicate internally.
So we mentioned that defining your customer needs was an important part of creating marketing and brand strategy. Now, I think that we're being a little too vague there because I know what you mean. I've also got 20 years of experience. Mm-hmm. So I think we should define that a little bit, especially on the, like a startup basis, because sure. I see a lot of companies want to enter a market space and they're like, oh, we have this huge, our total addressable market is big. And I'm like, that's not a good thing. That's not a strength. Yeah. And they're like, what do you mean? We've got 58 million people could use this. I'm like, okay, so who are they? Who are they? Well, there's 58 million of them. I'm like, that's my point. There's 58 million of them. Like, are you buying Super Bowl ads? Or like, what's your approach here? So how do you suggest that an early stage business learn to really get their finger on the pulse of what a client or a user or whoever they're trying to reach needs?
Sure. Well, I think first, you know, as they're developing their product, and I see a lot of startup folks, they have this kind of build it and they will come mentality, right? The field of dreams. And so
it's a bad thing, by the way.
Yeah. It's a bad strategy as you start to identify, let's say, who your audience is, whether you're a consumer or B2B, once you've started to think about what that persona is to really go out and have conversations. And the other big mistake I find with startups is they tend to go to friends and family and ask, mm-hmm. what do you think? I worked, one of the things I do, I'm a mentor over at University of Irvine in their innovation group. And so I talk to startups all the time. And there was a particular one, they brought me in to, you know, give some advice. And it was an interesting model. It was a kind of a subscription shoe model, right? You get a pair of shoes and you keep them, you wear them as long as you want. When you're done, you send them back. They send you a new pair and then they donate the shoes. Well, it was an interesting model. So I said, have you done any research on this? And they said, absolutely. And it was mom and dad and my brother and sister and cousins and aunts and uncles. And everybody loved it. I said, well, I think you've got some issues here. And long story short, they just did not want to hear that they didn't understand their marketplace. So what I encouraged them to do was go out and talk to folks that they thought was their customers and ask them the same questions. So whether it's a consumer, and again, there's ways to have these conversations, whether it's qualitatively, which means, you know, frankly, just getting on the phone or getting a one-on-one in person and having a conversation with somebody. And the thing I highly recommend to any company, especially startups, is develop a discussion guide, if you will, a questionnaire to help you focus. Because what happens is if I went out and interviewed a potential customer to try to understand if my product was viable, and you went out and talked to somebody in the same market, well, we have different styles. So already we've put a bias on the research that's being done, right? So I recommend you have one, maybe two people that are doing this kind of research, not the receptionist, not a low level coordinator. You want somebody in the higher level that can help interpret the data and understand what they're asking and can do probing. And so just by doing that, and on a B2B side, you actually don't have to talk to a lot of folks. I mean, 15 to 25 max. you're going to start to see consistencies and responses based on what's going on. And then you can take that data, and I do a lot of qualitative. There was for a while there, I didn't do hardly any qualitative, a lot of focus groups, and then went to quantitative. And in the last 3 years, done a lot of one-on-one conversations, especially at the senior level. And that's an easy way to gather information, because what I see when I go to pitch meetings is, to your point earlier, it's a $400 billion market. All I need is 0.25% in order to make this work. That's great. How are you going to get it? Yep. And hope is not a strategy, as I said, and how to strategically to go after that 0.25% is just usually missing. And where I see the investors always pushing back is, how are you going to get there? Where when I've been involved and we've done research that kind of supports what they're going on, it adds that level of credibility that you're just not reading something in a book or in an article and deciding that you're going to go after that. So that is probably the simplest and the easiest way to go out and just have one-on-one conversations. If you've got a gazillion people that could potentially buy your product, it should be easy to find a handful of them to start to give you some feeling, to take it out of your gut of what's right and what's wrong. I worked with a startup for a couple years, actually. And it was a CEO who had retired from a big company, $400 million company in the environmental engineering business. Long story short, he created a program that allowed high school students to identify their best career choice prior to going to college, even selecting a college. So once they could do that, then they could figure out what was the best major, and then in turn, what's the best college. We probably argued ad nauseum about who our target audience was and about messaging. He was trying to use his experience as a CEO of an environmental engineering company that had three competitors in a very isolated market to mass marketing on the consumer side, where our customer was actually mom and dad and the user was actually the kid. And so there was always this confusion about what was the right messaging. And it took a long time to ever actually get to the point where it made any sense, just because he refused to listen. So I would always say to him, you're 80 years old. You're not the target audience, right? Get it out of what you think. We need to talk to the customers, the people who are going to use it and buy it. And that's what we ended up doing. We would hold events. We would present the concept of what the program was. We would give it free to people to do beta testing for us, with the idea that we had to get feedback from them and we could learn. And that's how the program got refined eventually before it got launched.
You know, one of the things that I'm caught saying a lot on this show is you got to listen for the echo. And that, you know, when it comes to talking to people about talking to what your clients, what your users, what your potential, either of those are looking for, if it begins to sound like an echo, you know, repeated, boom, mm-hmm. boom, 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 regardless of what it is, there's something to it. And it could, you know, that has to do when it comes to your product. Example, and I mentioned Gigabook earlier. So we had a point where we were getting like two or three live support requests every day, people asking about our subscription plan, which very quickly told me that we weren't clearly defining how it worked. And so we're like, God, it seemed very simple to us, but yet, okay, so it's based on user pricing, but our visitors were confusing a user with one of their clients. So they'd see $8 per user, which meant like, Angela, if you and I were masseuses, you know, we'd have a two user account. Mm-hmm. But we would see that and confuse that. We'd say, well, we have 500 clients, so that's going to be $4,000 a month. But, you know, that echo and that constant chirping, now, regardless of what it is, it could be feedback. It could be about your product. It could be about your marketing, or could it be about what people need? And I think one of the things when it comes to creating a marketing and brand strategy is, you know, what, and this is something that is simplistic on many levels, but so many people don't get, is like, what's the benefit? What benefit does your buyer or whoever's your consumer, what are they seeking? And mm-hmm. it's not always about like, and that's the thing that, and you know, still talking about Gigabook, as we created this brand message around it, I thought people would want to run a clean business. They would want efficiency. They would want reminders and notifications. As I finally got into it and I really listened, all they wanted was peace of mind. They just wanted to not have the phone ringing 10,000 times a day. If they could get that out, because, you know, these service providers, they were getting phone calls at 11:30 at night. Oh, can you cut my hair tomorrow? Instead, they just wanted someone to be able to say, here's my schedule, pick a time, book it. But and it took us a while to really kind of figure that out, because, you know, we were, don't miss an opportunity. Sounds like a great thing, but people really just wanted some peace of mind. Mm-hmm. So I think, and you look at like the things that make people buy, and you know, you talk, okay, so you mentioned that sneaker company. They probably weren't paying. So I'm a self-admitted sneakerhead. I have clients in the industry, and the difference between a worn shoe and an unworn shoe, like there's just people that won't touch it. They're like, I don't want to wear a used shoe. And the thing is like, there are literally, and the majority of the buyers in that industry, I'm talking like sneaker resale, like mm-hmm, fancy mm-hmm. Air Jordans and stuff like that. If you put them on your feet and wear them once, that's like that proverbial driving the new car off the lot. Now it's used, except for it's way worse. Yeah. It's way worse because you can always find a used car buyer, but in that case, you might not be able to find a used shoe buyer. So like I would poke holes in that right away. I'd be like, well, what about all the people that don't want it? Maybe some people do, maybe some people don't, but you have to advertise to everybody that likes shoes.
Right. Well,
I
was going to say that's interesting. And one of the other things that I said to them when we were talking, I said, if I just even think of my wife, she would not, number one, to your point, wear a used shoe, but number two, she likes to try them on. She likes to go to the store.
Yeah.
So now you're sending shoes to, and their target was women, frankly, young ladies, maybe 14, 15 to 25. And I don't know any girls that he doesn't like to go to the shoe store and try on shoes. So right there, a behavior that's pretty recognizable, you've just eliminated a major behavior in your model. And again,
but
they didn't
still have to advertise to the whole pool. It's another point with that. So it's like dead eyes. It's like, it's just not going to, you're never going to, it's not going to resonate. And, you know, and that's that whole thing is, if you have to advertise to an entire market to get a tiny portion of it, but you can't, your strategy can't focus specifically. And, you know, data is such a hot point. You talk about qualitative and all of it, you know, like apparently data is more valuable than anything on the planet. But the reason is it because it helps people get a message directly to the people that they need and want. And, you know, I was talking to someone about this, about LinkedIn advertising the other day, because, you know, LinkedIn is not, well, they do a lot of promotion, but for us, like at Full Scale, I can pick a company and I can pick a title. So if I know who's hiring for what, and I know who the people are that hire, I don't care if I'm paying a $200 CPM for an ad that literally says hire PHP developers, because I've narrowed it down to so many people, I'm going to have a hard time even getting it in front of 1,000 eyes. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like the question is how specific can you get? And if your brand, especially if you're an early stage company, if your marketing approach and strategy cannot be highly targeted and highly specific, you're going to have a problem. I ran into it. I did it at Gigabook, like, because we thought just appointment booking or appointment scheduling. Yeah. And then we ran into other things too, like having to get all the negatives out of it, because we ran our first CPC ad campaign and spent 50% of our money with people that wanted to make an appointment at a freaking DMV, because we hadn't really thought that out. So we had to, you know, narrow it down and narrow it down and narrow it down. It was it was frustrating. It was time consuming. It was expensive. And it was just really kind of painful overall, because it was like, oh my God. So, you know, like some things out there, and you've mentioned so many, by the way, you did something that you've made me do something that I don't do a whole lot. And you think I do more of, you made me write something down. I usually just kind of go into this freestyle, but hope is not a strategy. Okay. Amen, brother. And you also mentioned the field of dreams effect, which I talk about a lot. I get it. It's just because you build it does not mean it will come. So I actually want to pivot into that. What do you, all right, let's just say you have a business, you have a startup. Okay, now I've built it and I thought they were going to come and they didn't. How do you help fix that? Because I think that is a common thing right now.
Well, again, it's getting back to some of those basics. And one of the problems, I have a blog that I wrote, I don't know, a few years back, and there's no silver bullet in marketing. And I jokingly say silver bullets are if you're playing the Lone Ranger, you want to kill a few werewolves. But you can't just run a social campaign. You can't run a Facebook campaign. You just can't, do a billboard campaign and expect everything to change. I'm a believer in integrated marketing and, more importantly, integrated thinking. And those are all great, but it all boils down.
Let's define that real quick, if you don't mind. Please. And then I do want to hear the rest of it. But sure. I think I don't want to talk over anyone's head because I think it's an important point you're about to make. So integrated marketing.
Yeah. So, there isn't a one size fits all. And so it's important. And I'm going to use the word customer again, your prospects. You have to understand, for example, how they consume information. If we look at a customer journey, when they come to your website and the B2B side, especially, I think the latest statistic I saw, it's either 75 or 85% of all the research a potential customer does before they pick up the phone to call you is on the internet and they go to your website. So if I go to your website for the very first time, and I don't know you, so we're hopefully building awareness about your organization. I'm looking kind of superficially. I'm skimming through it, looking for the buzzwords and things that are relevant to me. Well, now when I come back the second time, or I've download something, I have a genuine interest in what's going on. So now let's say I'm on your page that talks about, in my case, market research. So I need to give them a little more information about what that is. How do you define that? The biggest problem I always run into about market research is the immediate response is that's too expensive and takes too long. I can't do it. And so I spend a lot of time trying to convince people it doesn't take a long time and it's not expensive. Not when you look to not do it.
Yeah.
Exactly. So you have to look at that journey. So you have to understand who they are. If you're targeting a 25 or 30 year old, well, you better have videos and those kinds of things on your website and your communication. But if you're targeting somebody, I'll say 55 plus, maybe and a little older, they might want paper. I know people that still want to download every document they can get their hands on. So you have to understand how they're consuming information. You have to understand where they are in this education process. There's a chart that I use in prospecting, and it says that it's going to take 7 to 12, maybe 13 times before you actually get into the realm of being considered for a purchase. So now you have to constantly be communicating and having these touch points with your customers. So you have to be relevant while you're doing that. You just can't say, hey, Matt, how you doing today? Like, I can't count that as a touch point. It's like, yeah, good, fine, thanks. Right. So what am I giving you that's relevant? And so there's this process that you have to be involved with. So back to integration is by understanding all these different ways that your customer may be looking at information and back to the integrated approach, multiple tactics, if you will, touch the ways to have that touch point. Could be a video, could be an email, it could be a phone call. It could be, hey, I did this yesterday with a client that I've been nurturing for 3 months. I went on, I found some new studies that are in the marketplace. Now, I'm not going to buy them, but I took some of the synopsis of it and say, hey, didn't know if you saw this, but I wanted to let you know that this market research now available in the market. So that was my touch point. And that was probably touch point number 9 with me, with this guy. Right. And so when you have a lot of these folks, you've got to figure out different ways to stay in front of them. And that's where integration comes in, because it isn't a one size fits all. I have someone told me, I do a post in LinkedIn, every morning. Did you see it? I go, I didn't go on LinkedIn until the afternoon, and it was probably so far down on my feed, I'd never see it in a million years. So again, how are people consuming? What's the right way? How many touch points do you need to have during the course of the day? And do you know that I don't go on? I do, but do you know that I don't go on LinkedIn until the afternoon? You know, how do I? So you have to be looking at all those things to integrate, if you will, a plan of attack.
It was last fall. I was talking to one of my peers, and probably the greatest compliment that I got last year. And he said, he's like, dude, I see you everywhere. And I just said, so it's working. It's like, and that was the whole point. It's like, you know, but that's a interesting, you know, thing, and it's hard to do. And, you know, by the way we did that was, we took a multifaceted approach. You know, we had the podcast. It was really starting to gain traction, getting people to share the podcast that they were on. And, you know, with that, there were things that we learned, like you are a lot more likely to share that you were on our podcast if I give you the cool things that you need to share. Mm-hmm. We like Angelo for being on this podcast before it's published. Our marketing department will send you a perfectly sized formatted image to share on social media. They will send you an audio preview that looks similar, all the things, including an email that even suggests what you might say in those posts. If you post this on Facebook, you might want to say, hey, I was on this really cool podcast called Startup Hustle. Check it out. And ever since we started doing that, more people were sharing. And then in some cases, we took an approach of experiential marketing, just giving someone an experience. And we had a Full Scale has a suite at a local concert venue. And we realized that, and I knew this because I worked in the music industry for a while, that was a powerful thing. And that even if you didn't like the Backstreet Boys, if we took you there and you had a good time, you would always remember us when it came time to decide if what vendors you needed for something. And, you know, you talk about stacking these things up. Sometimes it was a LinkedIn post. Sometimes I've written 3 books. So we had a robust campaign of like, if you went to the suite, well, we had these big boxes of just like they were, I don't want to say big boxes. We had a big stack of them. They said Full Scale on them. They had our books. They had product offerings. They had cool stickers and just shit like that. It was like, there was really no way that you were getting out alive when it came to escaping our marketing message. Now, you know, maybe you threw some of that away, but I see Startup Hustle stickers on laptops. Well, when I used to go out in Kansas City, I'd see them everywhere. I'd see copies of my book. That was strategic. Mm-hmm. Why? Because people don't feel good about throwing a book in the trash. They will throw your business card away before they get to their car. But people, there's just something weird about throwing a book in the trash. So you talk about all these different things and integrating like what's going to resent, what is one person going to like, another person might not. Some people don't read the book. And then there was even funny things that would occur too. People were posting pictures on Facebook. They're like, I'm never going to read DeCourcy's book, but it sure does hold up my table well. Thank you. Thank you. Well worth the price of sending the book. You know, I mean, I have pictures of people's babies reading my book, like all kinds of weird stuff. Like I've, you know, people posted pictures of my book sitting on the floor next to a toilet, you know, but the point is you get people talking about it and have fun with it too. Like, you know, like I loved the table leg picture. Like I was just like, that's freaking great.
That is really
I never
great.
Expected everyone to read the book. And then sometimes it's just goofy stuff too. Like the Startup Hustle logo. It's a cool logo. People like it. And I found it stuck on a lot of laptops, a lot of computers, a lot of stuff. And we'd always give people more. Like they would come by, I'd give them like 10 of them. And you know, some people I'd be like, oh, do you listen to podcasts? Oh, that's a podcast? All right. Well, hey, we took a shot. So, I mean, there's a lot of different ways to integrate your approach, but you know, there's 3 words that I've always used: test, test, test.
Yeah. Well, you just never know what's going to resonate, right? And to your point, you've got a lot of different things going on. That's the basics of integration, and you just never know. I was in the action sports industry for about 13 years, actually longer than that. I started off working for Pacific Sunwear, doing their research for them, and after about 9 years and meeting a lot of the leaders at that point in time, the McKnights and, you know, the Quicksilver guys and the Hurley guys, they would always say, we wish there was information, more information like this. There's just no research in our industry. And so, you know, being the marketing guy, I went, maybe there's an idea here. And so I launched and started a company called BoardTrack. And it was a quantitative research studies in surfing, skating, and snowboarding. And over the course of the year, I would utilize the data. To your point, I had stickers. I mean, I was a research company, but I was in the action sports industry. I would put stickers out. I would put t-shirts out. I would do anything I could do to keep my name in front of people. I'd give away data. I would do interviews all the time, a lot of speeches, a lot of articles. And so it's the same kind of thing now. It's you have to stay ever present because, number one, you want to be there when somebody decides that they need your service. You know, you need to be easily found and easy way to communicate. And so there is an effort, you know, that jokingly, as we were saying, the build it and they will come just doesn't work as a strategy. And so how are you going to reach that audience? If you're a startup, how are you going to really get to your core audience? How are you going to get them to buy? And everything you do should be documented because you're learning. To your point earlier on your calendar program, you learned that the messaging was not quite right. And so, and you learned and you evolved and you modified to make things work. And there's that feedback loop. There's so many times that I remember I was working with this company and they were in the credit card processing industry. And we were in a meeting and they were talking about how a bunch of retailers had fired them and, you know, got rid of their service. And so I said, well, let's go look at going to customer service, find out what's happening. Let's take that information, look at churn, and maybe we can come up with a predictive model so we can predict what the key attributes are that we hear from a retailer that potentially they're going to fire us. Well, they hadn't collect any of that information. It was just, you know, one guy had it on notes, one guy had it in a computer, one guy wrote it in Excel, another guy wrote it in Word. So there was no way to collect that data. So a lot of companies don't understand the power, especially as they get going, of the data that they do have inside and to really mine that. And that's, again, what does that cost? It costs manpower, but there's no, you know, physical dollars out of your pocket.
Yeah, well, overall, creating that strategy makes all the other stuff happen. And then, you know, I see that a lot. And it's easy to, I'll tell you what, man, it's easy to be busy. You're doing a lot of different things. You know, the marketing is, okay, until something's sold in a business, nothing else really occurs. And, you know, I think for those of you that are listening that are in early stage, you know, I think startups get caught up in funding. Oh, we got to raise another round. And I, you know, sometimes I mean, I've said to so many people, I'm like, you know, you could just try to sell something because eventually that funding is going to dry up. That runway is going to end. Sales or users in some cases are the validation for why that funding's coming in. And if you don't, you are going to very quickly run into a situation where people are like, okay, well, what does it cost to get a customer? And if you say, I don't know, people aren't, you're going to get to that stage where people aren't going to write you that check. Now, Speaking of what stage we're at, we have raced through this episode. I mentioned at the top of the show, I could talk about this all day. And thank you. You've got a lot of great input. And I think people will find it useful. If you want to just scroll down to the show notes and click the Ponzi Group link. If you want to find more about Angelo, he does a lot of great stuff. We had a call last week and talked about some of this stuff. And, you know, there's just really a lot of cool stuff that you can do. Look, you don't have to be an expert marketing strategist to have an expert marketing strategy. Go find a CMO. That's what I love about fractional services. You know, and we use a fractional CFO who's actually a sponsor of many of our shows. We don't do a ton of transactions. Like we have a couple hundred a month, and that's not a lot. That's not high volume. I don't have high end accounting needs and stuff like that. So being able to get expert fractional help at a portion of a full-time budget is very advantageous. 10 years ago, I wasn't a big advocate, just because I felt like I needed to figure out how to do everything myself. Now, man, it's like Frank Lucas in American Gangster, man. You got to go straight to the source, find the good shit, and don't be afraid to pay for it. You know, like if you have to take a raft through the middle of the jungle to get there, then do it. So now we end our episodes of Startup Hustle with what we call the founder's freestyle. I'd like to hear, and that's just a moment for you to wrap up. I'd like to hear anything you have to say about what we talked about today, but maybe if you have one golden marketing tip that you tell everyone, if you could share that, and if you've already shared it, then reemphasize it perhaps, but I'll go ahead and let you rock there.
Yeah. Well, I think the biggest thing for me is not rushing to tactics. A lot of times I'll get phone calls. I need a website. I need a social campaign. I need this. My question is why? I mean, what are you going to say? Who's your audience? So if I could say anything to your audience is start at the beginning. Who is going to buy your product? Figure out who that is and go have conversations with them to understand what their needs really are. Working with a telemedicine company, a software startup, and they had these 25 features and they were trying to determine what was the best features to roll out with because they were trying to raise money. Long story short, at the end of the day, they needed 5 of the 25 to become a viable product, which means they needed less money, less time to develop, which meant they were in the market much quicker. If they had gone the path that they were going, they would still be developing, and it's been 2 years ago. So by understanding what's going to get people to buy, what's important and the relevancy, and if you're in different vertical markets, you're targeting different consumers or different businesses, you have to understand who those consumers are, customers are in each one of those verticals, because just because they're going to buy your product or your service doesn't mean they're the same motivations, behaviors that are going to drive them. The other thing is your competitors. I usually get, it's our annual plan. Let's go out and analyze our competitors. And my point is, it needs to happen constantly. That's why I actually have an ebook on my website on establishing a competitive intelligence program. It needs to be ongoing. Why? Because your competitors aren't sitting still and once a year deciding they're going to take a look at you. If I'm doing it, I'm watching my competitors all the time. I'm always looking at what's going on. And I tell my clients, we have to understand why someone's doing something and what their behaviors are. And oh, by the way, they changed their messaging. Why did they change their messaging? We need to understand that. Did they identify an opportunity? Did they just leave a gap in the marketplace for us? And then that really, those kind of two combinations of looking at those helps really identify things that are going to differentiate you from your competition in the marketplace. So if I was going to do anything for any company, that is the place I would start, because I think by having some of that information helps you understand how you can get that 0.25% of that gazillion-dollar marketplace. You know, throwing a dart at the wall is not going to get you there.
Well said, sir. Well said. Now, before I end the episode, today's episode of Startup Hustle is sponsored by Fullscale.io. We can help you build a software team quickly and affordably. There's the one-liner again. Now, I think when it comes to, you know, we're talking about integrated marketing, and I think the one thing that I'd really like to key, or I think one of the key takeaways that are and messages I'd like to follow up in is, you know, integrated marketing sounds great, but you got to be good at one thing before you're trying to be good at six. Mm-hmm. And you know, there's a growth plan with marketing and strategy that, I mean, if you have a mega budget, then maybe you can pursue a bunch of different things. But I think you're best to look at it similar to a wheel, you know, a hub and spokes. And, you know, you got to try one thing. And then if you get good at that, you can often use that to connect another and another and another and another and another. And trying to be a master of 6 to 10 different types of marketing approaches all at once is probably going to end up with you being a master of none. Mm-hmm. And, you know, like now I'm not afraid so I would tell people my marketing approach is I'm looking for a crack. And when I find that crack, my first priority becomes to try to figure out how to shove an elephant through it. And, you know, that. it's okay to go out and look for a bunch of different things, and you can poke around at 10 different things looking for the crack. But when you find it, become a master at that and go boom. Because the thing is once you shove an elephant through that crack isn't going to be a crack anymore. It's wide open. And you mentioned a lot of competitors and other people are watching. Anytime you're successful, I wrote about this in my book, Million Dollar Bedroom. Anytime you're successful doing anything, you've already shot a signal flare up. Mm-hmm. And it's let everyone know your competitors are right behind you, whether you think you are or not. And if you're the first to it, don't get used to it because they're coming. There's 7 billion people on the planet and most of them are chasing a buck, you know? And so you just got to be ready for that. So, you know, overall,
that's another great point. Sorry to interrupt, but is the other thing I hear a lot of times is I don't have any competition. And that is, you do. I don't care if it's one other person or 100 other people. And that in itself creates a strategy. If you're the leader of the market, now you've got a leader kind of voice. If you're a challenger, you got a very different voice. And we could talk about that. And I know we're running out of time, but so there's always those different aspects. And again, back to everything you were just talking about of not, you know, becoming a master at a few and not, you know, a master of none. A lot of that goes back to what are those right ones to become a master of by understanding your customers and how they're, you know, how to reach them and what's of interest to them, what's relevant to them. It's going to help define some of that. So you're not all over the place.
You talk about if you really are the first. Okay, so if someone says I'm the only one doing this, that's actually a red flag for me because I wonder like, okay, first off, have they actually done the research and are they aware that they might not be the only one doing it? And then second off, at this point of business, life, and commerce, if you are really the first person to do it and you're the only one there doing it, is it really that big of a market? Is it really that big of a solution? Is it really that big of an opportunity? Now, occasionally you are first, but that is very rare. I've been jokingly saying, maybe not jokingly, but I've been saying for years that all original ideas are gone. It's like, if you truly have an original idea at this point, congratulations, because you're one of few. Because it's just, there's that many people doing that many things, that many businesses. And you know, like, I mean, you look at the internet and, you know, I first started doing e-commerce in 2009, that's 11 years ago, which feel in startup years is like 100, but it did feel like the Wild West in a lot of ways, but you know, there was still a shitload of people doing a shitload of different things. So now speaking of that, man, I'm all fired up because these kind of conversations get me going. I'm going to end the show because I got to get out of here and make sure that my business is not using hope as a strategy. So I'll see you next time, man. Thanks for your time.
All right. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Startup Hustle is brought to you by Fullscale.io, helping you build a software team quickly and affordably. Make sure you reach down and hit that subscribe button. Then come find us on Instagram. See you next time.